When, in 2005, I wrote the article for 442 that would lead to the thoughts that led to the pitch that led to inverting the pyramid, tactics were on the periphery of British football coverage. 8 years on, as I write this, they have moved into the mainstream. If not for the majority of English fans, then at least for a significant minority, watching Gary Neville dissecting the weekend's action by waving his hands in front of a giant interactive screen has become essential. Every newspaper carries regular tactical columns. There are dozens of tactics blogs, and terms like false nine and inverted winger have become commonplace. Inverting the pyramid has been part of that movement. It didn't, as some have suggested, cause it. Rather, it caught a wave that was rising anyway, and perhaps helped provide a historical context for those with an interest in analysing what they were watching. English football can still feel Luddite at times, but its consumption is growing in sophistication every day. In fact, it may be that in some, the interest in tactics has gone too far and become an obsession. I made the point in the prologue when the book was first published in 2008, but it's worth reiterating given that so many seem to cast me as some kind of tactical fundamentalist. I don't believe tactics are the only thing that determines how a side plays, and I don't believe tactics are always the most important factor in how a game works out. Rather, they are one factor among many, a neglected one perhaps, but just one thread alongside ability, fitness, motivation, power, and luck in an immensely complex tapestry. Not only that, but I don't believe tactics can be separated from the other factors. A physically fit team must play in a different way to a tired team. A team low on confidence perhaps needs to play in a more cautious style. A team that includes dilettantish players must set up in a way to cover those deficiencies. Everything is related. Equally, designations of formations can at times seem a little arbitrary. Just how far behind the main striker does the second striker have to play for 4-4-2 to become 4-4-1-1? And how advanced do the wide midfielders have to be for that to become a 4-2-3-1? And if the support striker then pulls a little deeper and the wide men advance, is that still 4-2-3-1, or has it become 4-2-1-3 or even 4-3-3? Given fullbacks often push high, so their average position places them level with the holding midfielders, why don't we classify some 4-2-3-1s as 2-4-3-1? The terms essentially are shorthand, often rooted in convention as much as actuality. A useful, if slightly crude, way of giving a basic idea of a lineup. In tactics, there are few absolutes. There certainly is no best formation, something I've been asked about repeatedly in the past 5 years. While there must be a basic balance of attack and defence, everything depends on circumstance, on the players available, on their physical and mental state, on the conditions, on form, on what a side wants from a game, and of course, on the opposition and their players, formation and physical and mental state. Not merely is everything related, everything is relative.